Arabic is the official language of more than 27 countries, and there are more than 400 million speakers of the language worldwide. Yet in the US, for example, less than 1% of students study Arabic. Studies have shown that those who speak a second language not only earn more, but are in higher level positions than their monolingual counterparts. And there's no shortage of studies that point to the benefits of students at the K-12 level learning a new language. The National Research Council in 2007 found that children who study a foreign language show greater cognitive development in areas such as mental flexibility, creativity, and higher order thinking skills. Qatar Foundation International inspires meaningful connections to the Arab world by creating a global community of diverse learners and educators, connecting them through effective and collaborative learning environments inside and outside the classroom. Qatar Foundation International builds bridges across cultures by increasing the number of K-12 students in the Americas and the United Kingdom with a good knowledge and understanding of Arabic language and culture by increasing the number and quality of Arabic programs in state and public charter schools in the United States and other countries. Qatar Foundation International supports the teaching of the Arabic language through grant giving and programming activities while increasing and professionalizing the supply of highly qualified teachers of Arabic, thus raising the visibility of a growing profession through grants, professional development, and free online resources. For more information on free teaching materials and available grants, please go to qfi.org and ispeakarabic.com. This episode is brought to you by the Mikkelsen 20mm Foundation, a non-profit based in Los Angeles, California, that supports and invests in leading-edge entrepreneurs, technologies, and initiatives with the potential to improve access, affordability, and student success in higher education. In 2016, 20mm launched the Mikkelsen Runway, the world's first accelerator dedicated to supporting innovations in higher ed and career training. Both were founded thanks to the generous support of renowned spinal surgeon Dr. Gary K. Mikkelsen and his wife Isla. Visit 20mm.org and mikkelsenrunway.com for more information. And now, a quick message from our friends at Class Central. It's been more than half a decade since free online courses from Stanford kicked off the modern MOOC or Massive Online Open Courses movement. Since then, more than 700 universities around the world have launched MOOCs, and more than 60 million people have taken at least one course. Class Central has been keeping track of the MOOC space right from the beginning. Over 10 million learners have used Class Central to find and review online courses. As the number one search engine for online courses, Class Central provides a comprehensive listing of more than 8,000 MOOCs. Class Central's MOOC Report blog contains the most comprehensive coverage of the industry, including a recent listing of the top 50 MOOCs of all time. To find out what's up, down, new, or just slightly left field in the world of online courses, head to www.class-central.com/report. Hello and welcome everyone to this sixth edition of the ASU GSV Summit series on the EdTech podcast. My name is Sophie Bailey and this is the podcast dedicated to bringing together the spectrum of learning and talent innovation from around the world. Do let us know where you're listening in by dropping us a voicemail on SpeakPipe or on your phone and emailing via the edtechpodcast@gmail.com. This week, I'm delighted to share a conversation I recorded with EdSurge CEO and co-founder Betsy Corcoran back in May this year. If you haven't already checked out the EdSurge podcast, then I urge you to do so, as it always has a fascinating roundup of EdTech news and guests. In fact, it was listening to the EdSurge podcast which inspired me to set up the EdTech podcast way back in early 2016. Anyway, we get into all of that in our conversation. In this episode, we talk about how Betsy left her secure role at Forbes at the height of the economic recession to embark on some educational volunteering, dust bunny collection, and to set up EdSurge in a bid to better understand why the future technologies of learning were not making it into the everyday schools of California. We also talk yoga, egos, and high-stakes student, academic, and entrepreneurial expectation in the Silicon Valley, as well as what Hamilton the musical has got to do with personalized learning. But first, before we kick off, here's Deborah Quazzo with the GSV Cap perspective on EdSurge to set us up for this week's episode. How exciting!
I think that what Betsy Corcoran did in establishing EdSurge really early in the development of the whole wave of personalized learning. And so she was really quite early. Today, it's hard to appreciate looking back, because there's now been so much written about personalized learning and issues around data and privacy, et cetera, that when she really began to sort of create this media entity that became EdSurge, she was really very much ahead of the curve and very, very early. What you had was a very accomplished reporter, very accomplished person from the media, who really decided that she wanted to bring to bear all of her talents into a sector she saw as critically important, but really lacking in fully transparent reporting and analytics. So I think what EdSurge has done, a couple things. One, it has served as a convener for teachers and for educators and for leaders starting the K-12 sector. They've now expanded beyond that, but has served as a real convener to talk about real substantive issues around deployment of technology in classrooms. And then a sort of second phase of the business model was to build this called Underwriters Laboratory, almost research-based function, where they really are looking at product by product. What does a product do? What is its efficacy? What's reported in by companies versus what's delivered on the research side? What kind of results are delivered and validated? So I think that that was just a sort of furthering of her mission around, you know, started with convening of educators, but then she began to create a platform for educators to be able to select products as they were thinking about it, using them. So I think it's been a real critical media resource. It is, you know, for educators to start, but really everyone in the ecosystem, as a go-to place for trying to get at real information about products and about issues. So it's really a multi-pronged platform that has really elevated the transparency within the education technology sector.
Thanks, Deborah. And whilst we're on the theme of industry legends, you can also check out extra videos and interviews from the ASU GSV Summit team this week, including Marianne Wright Edelman, founder and president of the Children's Defence Fund, Bill Gates in conversation with Deborah Quazzo, and a fireside chat between tennis star and education enthusiast Andre Agassi and Ted Robinson. For all this and more, join our weekly email or check in via the ASU GSV Summit, asugsvsummit.com, where the whole series is listed. A big shout out to the ASU GSV Summit, Qatar Foundation International, the Mikkelsen Foundation and Class Central for sponsoring this week's episode. And don't forget, if you're enjoying the series, you can drop us a review on iTunes, where you can also rate the show. So, without further ado, here's episode 86 on industry legend Betsy Corcoran, and let us know what you think via Twitter at @PodcastEdTech and at ASU GSV Summit. Have a great week. Yay! Okay, so I'm delighted to be speaking with Betsy Corcoran, who's the editor at EdSurge. So welcome, Betsy.
Thanks so much. I'm delighted to be here, Sophie.
Yeah, so we're both based in Utah tonight. I guess it's pushing 10 p.m.
It is indeed pushing 10 p.m.
Yes. We're in the marathon that is ASU GSV Summit. And I just wanted to thank you, first of all, because as I just explained, I suppose some of the catalyst to me setting up this podcast and quitting my job and launching it about a year ago was really listening to the EdSurge podcast and finding huge value in them. So when I was on maternity leave, actually listening to them whilst I was pushing my pram around, trying to keep up with what was happening in EdTech. And, you know, it really inspired me to think about whether there was something that I could do from out of the UK as well. So thank you for that.
Well, thank you. And that's fabulous. Congratulations to you for doing the podcast and keeping it up for a year. That's half the battle.
I know. It's been one episode or more every Sunday for over a year now. So that's
fabulous. Congratulations.
Thank you. So I suppose my first question really is, for people listening in, so it's a mix of educators, investors, startups, government and media types. How long has EdSurge been going and how did it get started? So I remember listening to one of your episodes and I think it was around, you and some academics and the discussion around it. I don't know, but what was the kind of initial story there?
Sure. Well, I spent a long, long time as a journalist. I wrote for lots of publications, including The Washington Post and Scientific American and Forbes magazine. And a while ago now, it was surprising to me what a difference there was between the technology that I wrote about for Forbes and the technology that I saw in my kids' own school. My kids were in elementary school or middle school in California in Silicon Valley. And so you'd think that that would be a pretty cool spot to be in a public school. And although our schools are fine and our teachers are wonderful and marvelous, in terms of technology, there wasn't anything very different than what I'd experienced growing up a long time ago, and that seems strange. And so I spent a lot of time thinking about it, and then I took that kind of that crazy move. I decided to quit my job in the middle of what we all pray is the biggest recession of our lifetimes and figure out how to do something in education. And I didn't know what. So I actually spent a year working as a volunteer IT support person in the public schools.
So that's really interesting, because then my second or next question was going to be about, in your description, in your bio, it's about taming dust bunnies. So what does that mean for people, especially back in the UK, who perhaps haven't heard that term before?
Oh, you don't have dust bunnies? I'm sure. Well,
I think we have plenty. I can guess what it means, but
well, you know, the school that I volunteered in, I was a little elementary school, about 350 kids. But like so many schools at this point in time, and this was 2010, so it wasn't that long ago, the school would migrate computers out of the library, where they had like a computer lab, into the classrooms. And so in a school of 350 kids, we were running 6 operating systems, which is ridiculous. And dust bunnies are those big clumps of dust that gather when nobody touches something for a really long time. And so I'd have to sit and blow them out of the way, try to update the computers, give up on some, suggest that they trash some, and try to bring a couple back to life.
I thought it might actually be a kind of way of talking about what we might term Luddites, or people who aren't really interested in taking on the new ideas.
But no, this actually means big clumps of dust that you find often under the bed, or in this case, under old computers.
So what's been your favorite story since you've launched EdSurge, and what's been the kind of learning curve? So was there any point where perhaps it didn't go in the direction you wanted it to? So, you know, you kind of learned from that experience and did something differently.
That'd be last week, maybe. So we officially launched EdSurge in February of 2011. And what I did is we started a very simple newsletter with just links to other publications and kind of a little bit of commentary about what those stories were about or how they connected to each other and that sort of thing. And I sent it to 50 people that I knew and said, hey, I thought I'd rate this newsletter and let me know what you think. And it sort of took off from there, which was pretty cool. We have learned so many things along the way, both about education, about technology and the intersection of those two, and about running a startup, which is not something for the faint of heart, I think. We tried lots of different experiments. We've tried a number of different ways of, you know, earning our keep, and some of them have worked and some of them haven't worked as well. And what has been constant has been we've always tried to deliver a surprising amount of value for everything that we do. So we've always wanted people to receive whatever it is that we do and go, wow, there's so much more here than I thought. That's probably not the smartest business thing to do, but it gives me enormous pleasure and pride. It means that people really care about what we do. And so favorite stories, running into people, random people who say, wow, EdSurge has meant something to me. It's helped me change my life. It's helped me change my career. It's helped me change my teaching. It's given me a new perspective on what I'm doing. And that's made it worth everything.
I was going to say that I think that EdSurge is quite responsible for sort of bringing together this nascent EdTech sector. So obviously now it's coined EdTech, but actually we're at the very beginning of something still. And, you know, it is still quite scrappy out there sometimes.
Yeah. And here's the really interesting question. I had a chance to do an interview today with Dr. Todd Rose, who's a professor at Harvard University and wrote a fascinating book called The End of Average. And the point of his whole book is there is no such thing as average. And yet everything we've designed in schools particularly is aimed at the average person. Well, it turns out that, you know, some people will learn some things faster than others. Some people will learn things more easily than others. And so we're now on this quest to personalize learning, to really say, hey, how do you learn best? And how do we bring the learning to you? And I think that that is a really exciting moment. Here in the United States, we have been all enthusiastic and kind of gaga, really, over this musical called Hamilton, which is opening in London in November.
I saw the obviously famous tweets after the
Pence was, yes, yeah. What I love about Hamilton, there's many things to love, but what I loved about one of the interviews with the composer, director, choreographer, everything, guy who did everything, Lin-Manuel, was he said, the whole purpose of Hamilton is to eliminate the distance between the audience and the story. And I think that personalized learning is about eliminating the distance between the learner and what they're trying to learn. And that is a really exciting prospect.
I totally see the, you know, the trend towards personalization. There are some interesting critics out there that also write quite well around the topic. Where are the nuances in that as well?
Oh, there's a ton of nuances. And there should be critics, right? Critics are a healthy thing.
Yeah, absolutely.
I deeply believe that and always will defend people's right to ask questions and to push back. Sure, there's a ton of issues, right? Included in those issues are, in order to do the kind of personalized learning that really sort of fits it to you, you have to know something about you. So that means we know a lot of data about you. Well, does anybody else have that data? And what happens if somebody else gets that data? So there have to be more protections and more safeguards, things like that. There is always a danger, especially in America, that we're looking for a silver bullet. And we think that there's one thing that's going to make everything perfect. And of course, that doesn't exist. But we always seem to be reaching for that. And that's a real danger, that in fact, the essence of personalized learning is really supposed to say, hey, you're going to learn differently.
Yeah, yeah.
Maybe you need to learn with a piece of paper and a crayon. Cool. So that's what you should do. And I think that one of the things that we've always tried to do at EdSurge is to be thoughtful about how we write about technology. It should always be that if the right answer, the right way to learn something is, hey, right now you need, you know, a pile of sand or a piece of paper or a computer. Great. But figure out what you need first, yeah, and then figure out what the right tool is. And that tool, again, could be a pencil.
So you're very much based in the Silicon Valley. As an outsider, so we have this vision of Silicon Valley, so lots of, you know, VCs, yoga, perhaps big egos.
There's a lot of yoga.
There's so much yoga.
There's a lot of egos, yeah. So far, you've got it pretty right.
Yeah, I mean, you pick up a certain vibe. So, I mean, what's the flip side of that? So that's one version of Silicon Valley. Can you tell us about perhaps the other side of it that isn't that?
Yeah, there are some real challenges. One of the center points of Silicon Valley, of course, is Palo Alto. Palo Alto, which is where Stanford University is located. It's sort of the epicenter of Silicon Valley in a lot of ways. There's been, over the last few years, quite a large number of suicides among high school students. They feel, in many instances, a lot of pressure. They have some very high-achieving parents, families, and that's been hugely problematic, is trying to help kids understand how to live in a community or how to live in a world where the newspaper is triumphing, you know, trumpeting the fact that some six-year-old has just, you know, found the next element on the periodic table, right?
Or like the cure for cancer and, yeah.
That's right. So it can be a very challenging place to grow up. It is not a particularly diverse environment. We need to, there is so much power and so much strength that comes from diversity, that comes from a diversity of points of view, comes from a diversity of backgrounds, diversity of, you name it, genders, racial backgrounds, education backgrounds. And Silicon Valley is at risk of being too homogeneous, too much the same.
It's interesting you said that because I listened to the CEO of LinkedIn speak yesterday and he was talking about the value of diversity. And I quickly had a search on their board and, you know, I think it was almost entirely white with two women in marketing and HR, which isn't, you know, that surprising.
It's not exactly as diverse as you'd like it to be, right?
No, and the same thing tomorrow, meeting the head of diversity and inclusion at Snap. And I did the same exercise there. And again, it was quite similar. So I think there's this kind of conversation happening, but the actual practice is not perhaps.
That's right. We need to make sure that great words are matched with deep action, right? There is a nonprofit in Oakland, the Kapoor Foundation, which has really been at the forefront of trying to get organizations, companies to really step up, step in, take seriously issues of diversity. They've done a great job. And we have a long, long way to go. You know, Silicon Valley often does get accused of having kind of a frat boy sort of mentality. And there's truth to that. Now, there are still beautiful people there. There's thoughtful people. There are teachers and, you know, all kinds of folks. But, you know, could we be more diverse in Silicon Valley? Yes, I think so.
So today, obviously, from one Betsy to another, obvious segue.
Oh, ouch, that's harsh.
Sorry. And I've just read Tony Wan's article on Betsy DeVos's speech today. I didn't know if you had seen that in person or had any thoughts about what she said today or just more generally about where her kind of policy direction is going.
I did not, unfortunately, have the opportunity to listen to her speech in person. I think that everyone in the United States and certainly in education is really waiting to see what's the point of view of this administration. How will they take seriously everything from, you know, issues of diversity to issues of equity? In the United States, we really have been struggling, not just in Silicon Valley, across the country. We've been struggling with how do we begin to make sure that every child has a fair opportunity. That doesn't necessarily mean an equal opportunity. It means the opportunity that gives them an equal chance to move forward. And we do expect leadership from our publicly elected officials. So I think we're waiting to hear words of leadership. The question of vouchers and so forth is really, really complex. At the end of the day, I think we all have to remember that the goal is to give every child a fair shot at creating a wonderful and, you know, personally enriching life.
It seems like there may be similarities to the grammar school situation in the UK. I don't know if you've... So in the UK, our current government also sort of pushing to go more towards grammar schools again. So you do an exam, and if you pass that exam, you get into a perhaps better school than an average state school. And the similarity that I can see there between the sort of voucher system and grammar schools perhaps is those that can afford the prep to get into those schools perhaps might benefit. But I'm sure there are many differences between the two, but just...
There's a lot of complexity. Just because someone is, in theory, given a choice doesn't mean that they actually know how to exercise that choice. It doesn't mean that they have the information that they need to exercise that choice. Or there may not be elements in their life that allow them to make a great choice. And so, you know, you can say, sure, we'll give every kid a voucher. But if I'm a working mom and I can't get my kid across town, then I am potentially at risk in being... locked in to a school that gets hollowed out if lots of other kids leave.
Yeah.
And so, you know, once again, we really need to remember that this is about helping our kids. It's about giving the next generation a really great opportunity. And sometimes the wishes of the adults seem to take priority over the needs of the kids.
Yeah, and I think even it sort of seems to have gone from what can technology do to what can technology do for teachers to now people realizing it's sort of learner-led and moved on to that next round of discussion.
Right. And so, you know, there's a lot of conversation. And again, when I talk about personalized learning, I'm not trying to use a capital P and a capital L or any kind of trademark term. I think that many of the people who are most thoughtful about what personalized learning means say it should be student-led, it should be, you know, student-centered, it is supposed to be about the kids. Once again, coming back to Dr. Rose's book about the end of average, he's got some really profound ideas there.
Okay, I need to check that book out. One of my questions is, and you know, I'd be interested to hear your thoughts on this. So there are lots of articles around sort of valuations of companies. So which companies have got the best sort of investment rounds and that kind of thing. How do we find out more in terms of either the revenues generated by those companies or the outcomes so that the kind of conversation shifts to, you know, which ones will perhaps have long-term sustainability and, yeah, just looking at those different differences and the kind of number of articles on the former rather than the latter, so...
Yeah, no, well, it's a pragmatic question, right? So privately held companies are not required to release data publicly,
yeah.
Right? So the reason that sometimes there's a little bit of a fixation on the funding rounds is because companies will release the funding rounds because they're pleased with them. And it's a proxy because presumably the investors have spent a certain amount of time looking at things like the revenue or the results. And so there, and it's not a perfect proxy, but it is a proxy, right? And that's why it gets used so much. Because other than that, unless you're a publicly traded company, you're not required to release any additional information about your profitability or your revenue or something like that. Now, there are other ways. There have been a number of meetings very recently here in the United States around efficacy and what
can
we...
So like the Jefferson Accelerator Program.
Exactly, yeah. Exactly. And what can we say about the efficacy or effectiveness of different tools? And I think that, you know, we're trying to figure that out. It is harder than measuring the effectiveness of a refrigerator.
Absolutely. I was talking to Bart today, actually, and I think what he's setting out to do is similar in London with Professor Rose Luckin at the UCL Knowledge Lab. She's got something similar with a project called Educate, which is looking to provide startups with research assistance and grants to help prove the efficacy of what they're doing again. But
that sounds great. I'll have to read more about her research.
No, yeah, she's a really interesting academic. She does lots on machine learning and AI. And yeah, she's very outspoken on all of that. So last few questions. I always ask people, what are the books, people or resources that inspire you? So you've mentioned one already that you know, if you were to share with people, and anything that perhaps you go back to, and it doesn't have to be around business or education, but when you think about who you are, that they perhaps are important in that.
Oh, goodness gracious. That's such a big question. So I'm not going to give you a perfect answer, but you know, sharing a couple of things. Definitely Todd Rose's book, The End of Average, super interesting within the school environments. I am fascinated by the Hamilton phenomenon because what Lin-Manuel did was he took 881-page biography of Alexander Hamilton and he translated it into something that was contemporary and meaningful to a huge swath of people. I hope it's a great success in London too.
So I did not know the backstory of that at all. I just kind of saw a musical and yeah, so that is really
fascinating. It's an amazing piece of work. One doesn't want to go too crazy, but in some ways it's a little bit like what people must have felt like when they heard Shakespeare for the first time, because it's a remarkably contemporary piece of work, but based on this story that's more than 200 years old. And
so me, I'm going.
Yeah, go get a ticket if you can. So that's been really profound. Truthfully, Sheryl Sandberg, COO of Facebook, just came out with her book, Plan B, which talks about the aftermath of her husband's death.
Yeah, I mean, it was funny because... So a lot of my friends and I have obviously read Lean In, and then you become sort of personally invested in her story. And obviously in that book, she talks about her husband quite a lot and how, you know, I wouldn't be here if I didn't have that support as well. Not obviously from her husband, but from my own husband. But Yeah, and so I actually felt quite shocked when that happened, and so probably more personally invested in it than, you know, I thought I was aware of. It was quite a shock when it happened, actually.
So I am one of the probably hundreds of people who can say that, you know, Dave Goldberg actually was an advisor to me personally and to Ed Surge. He genuinely was a giving and just a delightful human being, but mostly just a giving person who really gave of his time. And I was really impressed with Cheryl's most recent book, talking about how we deal with grief and how we deal with the traumatic moments in our lives. I think a lot of it's a death of a husband is, or the death of a child or family member is obviously very profound, but particularly for, you know, entrepreneurs, they go through some pretty big ups and downs.
So you're talking
as well.
About suicide rates in schoolgoers in Silicon Valley, but I know that it's also higher, and mental health issues and depression with entrepreneurs as well. So, you know, that it is quite a lonely pursuit sometimes.
So that's a book that I've also found really interesting. Yeah, it's just come out recently. And then I'm going to give you a totally free plug, and this is horrible, shameless personal plug, but my husband is a book writer and is coming out with a book in August, and it's called Prepared for Anything: Why Your Liberal Arts Degree is Worth More Than You Think. And in it, he talks about the value of a liberal arts education and talks about how some of the traditional things that we learn in the liberal arts degree through that pursuit of that degree makes us critical thinkers, makes us creative. And in a world where we're very enthusiastic about coding, does everyone have to be a coder? Maybe not. Please consider this an absolutely shameless plug for George Anders' book, Prepared for Anything.
And so what's his background in terms of writing that, and what does he do?
Oh my gosh, he's a book writer. He wrote for the Wall Street Journal for 30 years, was part of a Pulitzer team. In fact, you'll be pleased to know we met in London.
Ah, there you go. Whereabouts?
Well, we both worked in London. So.
Okay, amazing. That is really interesting. And I think it's quite timely because obviously all of the discussion at the moment is about jobs directly going into careers, becoming quite a vocational exchange and skills-based. And actually, when you think about what people are saying about automation and who will kind of remain outside of that, is the kind of humanizing aspects of it, is what makes us creative and what can't be replicated. So yay for humanities and all
that.
Yay
for humanity. It is kind of fascinating to think that in some ways we have this growing interest in machine learning, and yet what we really also have simultaneously is a growing interest in how we do more creative learning, personalized learning, learning that helps us not just do the rote stuff. So interesting tension there between the two.
And I like your thoughts on coding as well, because this Sunday's episode is with Ted Fujimoto. And that was a fascinating interview. And he was, you know, he relayed our current obsession with coding to when he was at school doing keyboarding classes.
Right.
And does it become just a utility? And do we need to actually have that much about the, you know, the mechanics of coding, or is it just being able to understand of the concepts that you can brief and so on? So
some of these conversations we had about, at least in the United States, when we started introducing science education way back when, and I'll be mistaken about the dates because it's a little late at
it
night
late,
right now.
Yeah.
But if you go back and you read the history of introducing science to the school curriculum, they raised a lot of the same questions. Are we trying to teach everyone to be a scientist? Are we trying to teach the scientific mindset? We now do believe that the scientific mindset is a really positive thing for kids to have. You also have a writer's mindset when you teach how to write. And the coding folks say, well, there's a coder's mindset too. So, you know, sometimes the only mindset that we somehow leave out of the conversation is how do we have a playful mindset? And that's another part that would be
nice
to keep into
between all of them as well.
Yeah, exactly.
Playful mindsets like that. How do you relax? You've got a very important job. It's very busy.
Well,
we're here
going
at 10
to bed
p.m.
after this interview.
Yeah.
I'm sorry. You know, I don't know. I like to swim, and I think that I am very, very fortunate. I have a terrific family and great, very supportive husband who's also got, as I said, his own great career too. So that's probably the most fun.
And if people are listening to this, they're interested in what you're doing. Obviously, I think you're on Twitter or certainly EdSurge.
Sure. Well. Yeah. Please follow us on Twitter. Follow us on, you know, at EdSurge, or I'm just Betsy with an underscore after Betsy. Please follow us on Twitter. Please subscribe to an EdSurge newsletter. We have three newsletters that we do these days. EdSurge Innovate was our sort of original one, and that's aimed at a little bit of the entrepreneurial mindset. EdSurge Instruct, which comes out on Thursday. So EdSurge Innovate comes out on Wednesdays. EdSurge Instruct, which is a little more teacher-focused, comes out on Thursdays. And then for the last little year and a change, we've had EdSurge Next, which is on higher education.
Ah, very interesting.
Sign up for all three.
And
three for the price of one.
Three for the price of one.
And the price is zero.
There's no paywall with EdSurge.
No, there isn't.
Ah, there we go. And final question. So what are your plans internationally? So EdTech's becoming more and more international.
Well, that will have to be a secret that you and I will have a longer okay. conversation about.
There we go. All right. Well, thank you very much, Betsy.
Thank you. Appreciate it.
Well, that brings us to the end of this seventh episode from the 10-part ASU GSV Summit series. Don't forget to sign up to our newsletter to find out about upcoming meetup drinks, cool jobs currently circulating, and other announcements. For full references, show notes, and book recommendations, go to theedtechpodcast.com. And for competitions and more, go to our Facebook page, www.facebook.com/podcastedtech. If you like what you hear, why not drop us a loving review on iTunes? And come back next time for our following episode featuring a focus on Australia and EdTech.